You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last year, Americans paid four times as much as the French for cable television, phone service, and the internet, and in return, they got internet speeds 20 times slower. America ranks 29th in internet speeds internationally, and other countries are passing us. The reason? The lack of a competitive market for high-speed internet access and no government oversight. This is just one of many instances of American consumers paying more to get less that Pulitzer Prize winner and investigative reporter David K. Johnston exposes in his new book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. It's published by Penguin, and I'm very pleased that it has brought David K. Johnston back to our show.
Welcome well, thank
back.
You for having me again, Leonard.
You say that we aren't just 29th in internet speed, but 29th and falling.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, other countries recognize that the internet is to the digital economy of the 21st century what canals and railroads were in the early 19th century. And, of course, America prospered because we invested in and built these common carriers. We paid for the kind of internet that they have in France and South Korea and Japan through rate increases totaling for both cable and telephone companies more than $500 billion. But the companies are only building it in a very limited area. In fact, actual fiber optic service will only be available through companies to about 16 million Americans from Verizon. AT&T system doesn't have fiber optic right up to your computer. And so some cities around the country have built their own municipal systems, just like they built electric municipal systems when corporate America didn't want to serve them 100 years ago.
Now, you'd never know that from watching the ads on TV, all those ads that claim one service is the fastest and phone companies touting their 4G capabilities
right.
and their coverage.
Well, and that's
to show us maps.
That's right. And that's wireless service. And interestingly, I went to the FCC and said, do you have a map of the internet capabilities of the United States? No. Went to the Pentagon. Do you have one? I mean, I can see an important national security. No. Now, maybe they do, and they're not telling the truth about it at the Pentagon. But our competitors are all building universal systems, and we rank behind Moldavia and Ukraine and Lithuania and Latvia and the speed of our internet. That's insane.
What are the reactions of the corporations to municipal internet providers?
Well, they sued in the early days to try and stop this, and I tell the story of Glasgow, Kentucky, where people save an enormous amount of money because they built such a system. And a conservative federal judge, when he was presented with this case, looked at the company lawyer trying to shut it down and said, oh, so you just don't want to have competition. In several states, including North Carolina, the legislature has passed laws that make it virtually impossible or actually impossible to create a municipal system, even though the places that have done so are now prospering economically.
But even if there isn't a municipal system, we're stuck with one provider. When I moved, I was told that I was going to have a different provider. It turned out I was still with Time Warner. And New York City alone has just been divvied up between two or three different providers. There's no real competition here.
Right. Well, the apartment building we have a place in here in Manhattan has two providers. But the problem with it is, however, that Verizon, for example, is now making deals with Comcast, and they intend to make them with others. And what we're seeing is the emerging cartel of AT&T, Verizon, CenturyLink, Time Warner, Cox, Comcast.
Now, I was going to save this question until we talked about railroads, but aren't there antitrust laws which prevent corporations from creating cartels?
There are antitrust laws from 1890.
Teddy Roosevelt and others.
That's right. And they are, of course, designed to encourage what I try to promote in my books, which is the rigors of market competition. That's how we get real economic growth. There's nothing business hates worse than competition. So they have been doing several things. They've gotten laws passed that exempt them from various provisions. They've gotten laws passed that appear to allow competition but actually make it totally impractical. And our Supreme Court, with its conservative majority, has been totally hostile to the idea of antitrust laws for a long time.
So since there's no government regulation on telecommunications in this regard, they don't have to do anything because nobody's forcing them to do it.
Right. And they can go out and tell you, gee, here's how fast you are, even though if you go to these other places, your internet will be – if you go to Chattanooga, you can get an internet run by the city government that's 20 times faster than what you can get in New York City.
And you also write that phone bills have become too complicated to understand. Why isn't what isn't clear in all those charges that I see listed?
Well, if you look at old phone bills from the 1930s, the 1950s, as I did, there's a charge to be connected to the system, and then there's a variable charge based on how many long-distance calls you make.
And, now, and they charge you for equipment.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Now you have these bills that are incredibly complicated for not just phone, but other services. One electric company, Arizona Public Service, has 26 different items. My electric bill at home in Western New York has a charge on it just to prepare the bill. And by creating all these little extra charges, what they're able to do is you raise this one here this month and another month, and pretty soon you it turns out that you're paying far above the rate of inflation in increases.
And that's despite the fact that pretty much the infrastructure remains constant for a while.
Yes.
So how do they explain this beating out the rate of inflation?
They actually haven't explained it. But I will tell you, one of the big trends—
aren't they regulated?
Not really anymore. That's what we have is pseudo-regulation now. And one of the stories I tell is about American Water, which is New Jersey's biggest water supplier. They have raised their rates tremendously. And now they're saying to their workers, you know, we can't afford to pay you what we've been paying you. You're going to have to take significant reductions in your compensation package. I'm sorry, you just got big rate increases.
Well, so what? How do they justify that? Aren't their profits a matter of public record?
Oh, sure they are. But if you have public utilities commissions that no longer, you know, in a number of states, we've gotten rid of the consumer advocates, the people appointed to these commissions of all kinds, the Federal Energy Commission, the Surface Transportation Board that does railroads, they come from and go to the industry, and I document a number of these. And when I started writing about utilities in the 60s, there were on every board I ever covered at least some people not from the industry. Now you have boards dominated by people who come from and go to the industry that they're regulating.
Pretty much everything we do involves fine print at some point. When I moved recently and had to have my phone service changed and my internet service, Time Warner sent me stuff with fine print. If I go on the internet and I want to add some app, there's this long thing that I either agree to or disagree or reject. If I reject it, I don't get the app. In the end, we wind up just saying accept, accept, accept without really reading it. Should we be reading those things? And where should we be looking for the important stuff?
Well, it's efficient to have what are called contracts of adhesion, these one-sided contracts that benefit the company. But in order to have those, you have to maintain something called the doctrine of unconscionability. That companies can't do things that are just shock the conscience, and yet they do. I mean, I tell about a woman who was sold a single mother in Washington, D.C., a car for 3 times its value, and Wells Fargo tried to take her house away from her when she wanted to give the car back. What's happened in the last 30 years with almost no coverage from the news media, and this book is full of stuff that has never been reported anywhere unless it's by me, is that ancient doctrines that go back to Hammurabi, are being rewritten and changed by this one-sided apparatus that we're creating, and it is business promoting these regulations that are for business and by business and against consumers. And by the way, I teach the regulatory law of the ancient world at the law school and the graduate business school at Syracuse.
So it was better to be a debtor in Samaria than it is to be in the United States right now?
Well, interestingly, in ancient Samaria, you could be sold, if you didn't pay back a debt, to slavery for 3 years, and then you had to be freed. Today, you can be pursued to the end of your life, despite our bankruptcy laws, for some kinds of debts.
My guest is David K. Johnston. His book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. It is published by Penguin Portfolio. But consumers were actually protected by the government in ancient Samaria, except when they were sold into slavery.
Yes, all of the modern law you can find in the ancient world, and there were consumer protections. And what we had then was balance. And what we're getting now is a lack of balance. these regulatory agencies are basically only paid attention to by the companies being regulated. I mean, when did you last read a news story in my former newspaper, the New York Times, that went into the policy decisions of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, even though it affects how much you pay for electricity?
But aren't we hearing, at least from one of the major political parties, that we are overregulated?
Oh, we're hearing that all over the place. Most of the regulations that we have were sought by business, and their principal duties, I show in the book, are to thwart competition, avoid the rigors of the market, reduce your rights as a consumer, allow them quite literally to put your life in danger and charge you for the cost of doing so. And that's the problem in this. You know, if nobody watches what goes on in a democratic government, then the people who pay attention get what they want out of it.
So regulation, you're saying, is really not regulation, and it's definitely stacked in the favor of the people who we think are being regulated.
The whole concept of deregulation is a fraud. There is only new regulation. Everything is regulated. Baseball regulates how many stitches are on the baseball and what color the yarn is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you rewrite the rules to benefit the companies, particularly this is going on with the electric and utility companies, cable, telephones, things like that, that are essentially monopoly services, you can do tremendous damage to the, to the economy while at the same time producing outsized profits for these companies.
And I want to talk about one of those famous companies, Entergy, when we come back. Also, the railroads and whatever else we can get to. My guest is David K. Johnston. His book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, it's published by Penguin Portfolio. Stay with us. We're back with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, author of the New York Times bestsellers Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal, and also recently elected board president of Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. It's published by Penguin Portfolio. A listener writes in asking you to discuss alternative electric services for Con Ed, which claim to be cheaper.
Right. Well, New York is one of the states that broke up its vertically integrated utilities so we could have, quote unquote, market competition. The problem is if you bought your electricity from somebody else and had Con Ed deliver it, you had no way of knowing at the end of the year, did I pay too much or did I pay too little? Now, unless something happens on Monday, the records of how one company in New York, not Con Ed, allowed various firms to sell electricity, how that worked out will become known.
So we'll know whether you save money or not?
That's right.
But we have to wait until Monday?
And it will give you some insight into which of these electricity providers were gouging your pocket and which ones were actually providing you with a benefit. But it is extraordinary that we created a quote-unquote competitive market with no power for consumers to compare prices.
You detail the billing practices used by the New Orleans-based energy corporation, Entergy, that cost taxpayers over $50 million. How did that happen?
Well, there was a fellow I write about named Joe Sieber, who makes his living auditing electric bills for businesses and governments. And for 30 years, he's been proving that Entergy was cheating customers, and they've paid big refunds, in some cases millions of dollars. About 5 years ago, Entergy decided they'd had enough of this guy, and they arranged to get him jailed. And I went down to
New Orleans. Under what charges?
Well, it's a very complicated story in the book, but essentially there was a power pole that fell over and left a man partially paralyzed for life, and the power company took the position that it was his fault because as the auditor of the electric bills, he should have told Entergy that its rusty power pole was in danger of falling over. I mean, it's a ridiculous argument. And it was very clear when I went to the hearing that Entergy's lawyer walked in and out of the judge's chambers like they were his own office. The judge was about to sentence the guy to 45 days in jail for simply writing a letter to the company about its cheating. When the judge looks out, sees this one bearded guy sitting in the audience and asks who I am, and suddenly the whole tone of the room changes. And then the company's lawyer comes to me and he says, well, you know, this guy is just a terrible pain. You know, how do we get rid of him? And I said, well, that's really easy. Stop cheating your customers. His business goes away if he can't prove you're cheating people.
Now, what happened when it was revealed that they had, I'm using your word, cheated consumers out of $50 million? Did they have to pay back the money?
Well, what they then do, particularly in the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana, they serve four states, is they've gone to the politicians and made settlements where they pay a tiny fraction of what they actually owe, which is what ticked off the guy I wrote about, because he expects to get paid for all the cheating he finds. And this is one of the problems that all across the country, companies, when they're caught cheating, they pay virtually no penalty for doing so. So why wouldn't you go right on doing it?
And Joe Seiberg got a second contract to audit Entergy in New Orleans. Did he find out that they were continuing to overcharge?
Actually, what he found was that they had gotten even more egregious in their misconduct. And he was stunned by this. He thought they would clean up their act. So he went back through public records to the 1880s to show how it's been the practice of this company from day one to cheat governments. And all across the country, utilities do this. I mean, he's found companies, and there are competitors in the same business, find utilities cheating people in every state, particularly governments, local governments, suburban cities. Happens all the time.
I mentioned railroads. You say railroads are also overcharging consumers. How much competition is there in the railroad industry?
None. I mean, the railroads will tell you in their public documents they face intense competition. But the reality is that they are here's my favorite rule the railroads have. Say you are shipping coal to burn for electricity, and there are two rail lines by two railroads that run side by side for 1,000 miles, and the electric power plant is 1,001 miles away, and only one railroad serves that power plant. Well, so you would think that the local municipal or privately owned utility would negotiate a deal for competitive rates for 1,000 miles, and they'd pay an exorbitant rate for 1 mile. Mm-mm. The Surface Transportation Board, the regulatory agency of the federal government, has something called the bottleneck rule. And under that rule, you pay the monopoly price for the whole 1,001 miles.
And I'm assuming that the same would be true for a farmer who needed to rely on railroads to move crops. If they have access to two different railroads, they're still stuck with only being able to use one?
Yes, and Warren Buffett's railroad is notorious, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, for just not sending cars when it's inconvenient for them, which can damage the farmers. And let me give you an idea of the cost of this.
You mean saintly Warren Buffett?
Yeah, saintly Warren Buffett. There's a lot about Warren Buffett in this book. The Lafayette, Louisiana, that I mentioned, in Louisiana, that has its municipal system, if they were not gouged by the railroads, if they could get competitive prices, it's the functional equivalent of cutting everybody's property taxes 10%.
We're talking about shipping things on the railroad. What about people who ride the railroads? Are they being overcharged as well?
Well, there's very, very little passenger traffic. That's all done almost entirely now by government agencies.
Amtrak.
Amtrak.
And many people complain that Amtrak is way too expensive. Are they overcharging us?
That question I can't answer. I can tell you this. If there's an accident on an Amtrak train that is not at all Amtrak's fault, this was in my last book, Free Lunch, and there are damages paid, they're always paid by the taxpayers. So if CSX has a dangerous piece of roadbed, as they did in South Carolina, and people die, and a jury says $50 million in damages, it's the taxpayers who pay the bill because they are completely exempted from costs. And that's part of a fundamental trend, Leonard, that I describe in the book, where we are separating reward from responsibility.
Well, Amtrak was created by Congress as a for-profit corporation. And in theory, we're not to pay any of their losses.
In theory. But it was also created because the freight railroads wanted out of the passenger business. That's the reason. And if we were to get rid of Amtrak in the Northeast Corridor, think about what that would do to the, try driving the I-95 a lot of days up and down the Northeast Corridor and you sit and sit and sit.
In 1999, there was a huge explosion in a town that sounds like an internet spot, Whatcom Falls Creek, a small community in Washington State. What caused that explosion?
Well, this was Whatcom Falls Creek actually flows into downtown Bellingham, Washington, and a Shell Oil gasoline pipeline, scalding hot, high-pressure gasoline moving through it, burst. The gasoline is flowing towards downtown, and just before it got to downtown, two little boys playing in the woods with a butane lighter ignited everything. Otherwise, we would have lost downtown Bellingham, Washington. And it's because of that accident and the parents and the federal prosecutor in the case that we got the first law requiring inspection of pipelines.
Now, it's interesting because there's a there was an explosion right here in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint, and until the BP debacle, it was the largest oil spill in North America, larger than the Exxon Valdez, and nothing was done. Only recently have there been any attempts, and we're talking about the highest population city in the world, in this country, I mean, and you talk about a large pipeline that runs through New York that's separate from that, and nobody knows where it is?
No. In New York, I describe a whole series of huge pipelines that come in because Manhattan consumes a tremendous amount of natural gas, and I quote various fire officials about what would happen if there was to be an explosion because of this. And we know in San Bruno, California, just south of San Francisco, 2 years ago, an entire city block blew up. One of the people killed, by the way, was the State Public Utility Commission staffer who was supposed to investigate whether the pipelines were safe or not. We have pipelines that were laid when Truman was president in open fields that are now in urban areas. They're still being operated. They should be replaced. And the federal government is now giving what they call special permits, I call safety waivers, so that you don't have to inspect some of these pipelines at all. And many of them run underneath parks, hospitals, past schools where children are. If you're a school principal and there's a pipeline near you, you will get a colorful brochure every year telling you how wonderful the pipeline industry is. And if you read all the way through to page 5, you will suddenly come to a line that says, you are receiving this notice because your school is in a high consequence area. And that's all it tells you. It doesn't tell you what to do or what that means. And high consequence area is the industry euphemism for zone of certain death.
So the pipeline is running underneath the school.
Or in front of it or alongside it, yeah.
And, but we can't gain – nobody is going to provide me with a map of these pipelines if I request.
Well, where the waivers are, they will not give you a map. The federal government says they are concerned that terrorists will locate these uninspected pipelines. Now, the one ones I point out to are in western New York, where I live. I live up near Rochester. They run through generally rural areas, but they do go through towns and cities. And no self-respecting terrorist is going to blow up a pipeline in Canandaigua, New York.
My guest is David K. Johnson. His latest book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, it's published by Penguin Portfolio. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We've been getting calls from our listeners, and they've been writing to our show page with questions. One asks, if companies can change the terms of a contract on a whim, then how is a contract ever to be followed?
Well, this is a real problem in contract law. If you carefully were to read through the terms and conditions, which are designed not to be understood by mere mortals, often you will see a provision that we may, at our option, alter the terms of this contract. And it is an unlevel playing field. We've taken away recently from banks the authority to jack up your interest rate without any notice because they want to do so. But these other provisions, similar provisions exist for all sorts of industries, and we should not, as a matter of good law and good economic practice, allow that. But unfortunately, our courts, especially our Supreme Court, is very much in the thrall of Chicago school theories, which I'm very critical of in the book and explain why. And I went to the Chicago school. I'm not an economist, but I went to the Chicago school. And what I call corporatism.
Another listener asks, if you can discuss the consumer advocate group started by Elizabeth Warren, is it effective?
Well, I don't know about a consumer advocate group started by Elizabeth Warren. I've known Elizabeth Warren for about 20 years. She is a law professor now running for the Senate in Massachusetts, and she is the person who did a huge study of bankruptcy years ago and subsequent follow-up studies from the data that showed that bankrupts were not who we thought they were at all. She's documented that most bankrupts now are middle-class people who any two of the following three things happen to them: divorce, loss of job, serious medical bills. We're the only country, only modern country in the world where people go bankrupt and lose everything they have because of medical bills. And if we had universal public health, like, say, the French do, and we could lower our costs to the point where, as a matter of not reality, but it would be the equivalent of eliminating the entire corporate income tax. That's how much money we would save.
You write about companies that are able to keep the state income taxes that come out of their employees' paychecks.
Yeah, this is an amazing story that I'm the only national journalist who's written about. We have 2,700 big brand name companies, every big brand name company you've ever heard of in America, plus a number of them overseas, who have made deals in 19 states, and they're trying to get them in all 50, where the state income taxes withheld from the workers' paychecks do not go to government. They are kept by the company. Now, the workers are completely unaware of this because they're treated as having paid their taxes, and the legislature grants the companies a tax credit. And let's say you underwithheld. At the end of the year, you find out, oh, I owe the state of New York. We don't happen to have this deal, but you owe the state of New York an extra $500. New Jersey has this deal. So you write a check to the state of New Jersey for $500, you're really writing it to your employer. That means the rest of us have to make up for this with either higher taxes or less government services. And here's what's astonishing about this. I know by name the reporters at the New York Times, Bloomberg, and a number of other news organizations who know about this study and who were writing on it and reporting on it. Nothing ever appeared. Nobody knows about this unless they've read my work.
And Mitt Romney's Bain Capital, you say, is the recipient of these tax monies because it moved AMC Theaters to its corporate headquarters?
Yeah, Bain is an owner. Bain used to be the sole property of Mitt Romney until 2002. And Bain Capital made a deal to move AMC Theaters, of which it's part owner, corporate headquarters from downtown Kansas City, Missouri, about 10 miles across the Missouri River to Leawood, Kansas. And they will then get to pocket the next $47 million withheld from the paychecks of AMC workers in Kansas. This didn't create a single job. All it did was provide a subsidy to this company. And many of these deals do not save jobs or provide jobs. In fact, Navistar, the big earth equipment mover, has a deal where they can fire 25% of their workers, but they still get to keep the income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks.
Well, you keep on talking about how the press is ignoring a lot of these stories. You're the only one to uncover them. But Mitt Romney has been under attack from the media, hasn't he?
Haven't they
been uncovering these kinds of stories for him and other people in the corporate world because of this election campaign?
Leonard, I don't think that's attack. I think that's investigation, and that's what we're supposed to do in the news business. This is what I've been doing since I was 17 years old, is digging out facts. You know, we can have a news media that just tells you what PR spokesmen say, and that's, in fact, largely what we've gotten as the fastest shrinking occupation in America is news reporter. I don't know the numbers in Manhattan, but I know in Philadelphia, 80% of the jobs covering municipal government, schools, and other government functions in the city are gone.
You say that some of the reporting that we see on corporations is really investor-oriented reporting.
Oh, yeah. The whole focus of what you see every day is how does this work for investors? So when two airlines announce they're going to merge, instead of saying, well, what does this mean to customers, which is the largest number of the readers, listeners, and viewers, it's what this means to the shareholders, which is a tiny share of the market. And I think it's part of the reason people pay less attention to the news.
A listener asks, from the regulatory standpoint, which industries are worst?
I think the biggest problems are in telecommunications, because if we don't keep universal service, if we don't keep the legal right you've had since 1913 to a telephone at any address and make it to telecommunications at any address, our economic competitors, they're just going to run right by us. They're going to leave us in the dust, and 100 years from now, America will not be the economic powerhouse. It will not be the entrepreneurial powerhouse that it has been for so long.
Is there anything we can do as individuals to protect ourselves from being overcharged?
Not as individuals, but we can solve this problem. We got rid of slavery. We got women the right to vote. We got child labor laws. We got environmental laws. We have a lot of consumer protection laws. People have to work at it. You have to pick a subject you care about, get organized, work with other people, and remember what Susan B. Anthony supposedly said just moments before she died: failure is impossible. And remember that Teddy Roosevelt told us, in the long run, we will all go up or down together. So if we get the economics wrong, we will all suffer for it.
David K. Johnston's latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. It's published by Penguin Portfolio. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much, Leonard.